Hello everyone, welcome to the new week. It's Monday the 31st of August and this is episode 86 of the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. And before we start, I want to give a shout out to a new podcast that is coming on the podcast scene later this week. Will Evans and I are presenting the brand new Nature Friendly Farming Network podcast. Quite a mouthful, I know, which is all about farming with nature in mind. And we're meeting NWFN members from across the UK. So I'm really excited for that. It comes out on Wednesday and there'll be two episodes each month for this first series, with episodes coming out on the first and third Wednesdays of each month between now and Christmas. Today on Meet the Farmers, we're focusing on health and nutrition and I'll be speaking to food consultant Barbara Bray. Before that though, let's take a look at some news stories from the past week. In the news this week, the harvest nightmare has continued for many, with terrible August weather delaying combines and continuing the extremely challenging theme for arable farmers this growing season. The season of 2019 to 2020 will surely lodge in the memories of all the current generation of farmers, and the hope will be that another like it isn't seen again for quite a while, although a changing climate may suggest that this kind of season will become less and less of a rarity moving forwards. Time will tell. The National Federation of Young Farmers Clubs has a new president. International Rugby Union ref Nigel Owens has taken over from BBC Farming Today and Countryfile presenter Charlotte Smith, who has served 3 years as president of the organisation. A new world record sheep price of 350,000 guineas has been set by a ram lamb from the sportsman's flock of the Bowden family from Cheshire. This massively surpasses the previous record of 220,000 guineas set way back in 2009. And that is the news for now. It's now time for our main feature interview, and this week I'm speaking to a non-farmer, but someone who has thrown herself into the centre of farming circles and is passionate about encouraging farmers to think of themselves as part of a wider food sector. Yes, I'm speaking to food and nutrition consultant Barbara Bray. Meet the Farmer's Friends. So this evening I am speaking to a consultant who has food and nutrition at the heart of her work. Barbara Bray runs a consultancy business in the UK, which is focused on driving food safety in food supply chains and advising agri-food businesses on food and nutrition strategy. She has a real passion for talking about food and nutrition, which I'm sure we will experience tonight. She's a director of the Oxford Farming Conference. She's on the Food Science and Nutrition Committee for the Institute of Food Science and Technology, and she's also a trustee for the Nutrition Society. In 2017, Barbara was awarded a Nuffield Farming Scholarship and travelled to Singapore, Indonesia, Japan, Israel, and the USA to study international food and farming systems. In 2019, she was awarded an MBE for services to food and nutrition. Barbara, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's really good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
Obligatory 2020 question to start with. How's the lockdown and COVID been for you?
It's been a roller coaster. In fact, I heard that the first, when we initially had the lockdown back in March, I heard that it was like going through the stages of grief, and it did feel a bit like that. There was kind of like the anger and the questioning, and then it kind of calmed down because you realise that you had no control, so all you had to do was suck it up and get on with it. And I think the nice thing was, because it was the whole country, everybody was affected, and it made it seem like we all had to work together. But I think now that I'm living in the northwest of England, we're on a local lockdown, so I can't mix with any other households outside of my own. I can go and see my parents, but I can't play with my niece and nephew, for example, or can't even go to my next door neighbour. And it just feels like everyone else is moving on with life. And us in the Northwest, it's not more restrictive and just frustrating. And we're seeing the numbers of people with COVID going up in our area. And Yeah, it's left me kind of feeling that I haven't got the coping strategies nailed that I had a few weeks ago. I just need to revisit my coping strategies and kind of go, this is what I need to take me forward. Because I think initially I could do the coping strategies because I thought it was going to be 3 or 4 months. But now we're talking about a year or so. You need different coping strategies as far as
Yeah.
I'm concerned.
I asked Sue Pritchard on the podcast last week, actually, this question. I mean, I'm interested in your perspective as a nutritionist. Do you think that COVID has provided a wake-up call for us, certainly as a Western society, that we need to take food and nutrition more seriously?
I'd say yes and no, because I did a little bit of researching on Google Trends back in March. So when people started asking me to do webinars, I was looking to see what were people focusing on. And when you look at Google Trends for that period, the searches for the term vitamin C, immunity and veg skyrocketed. Then they kind of plateaued and stayed quite high. But also sales of alcohol and snacks went high as well. So
Okay,
it's almost
yep.
like there were two camps. There was the camp of people who said, right, I need to eat sustainably and healthily and look after my body and the planet. And the kind of people went, I'm just going to sit it out, on the sofa watching Netflix and eating snacks until it passes. So yeah, I think that there's been different camps. There are definitely some people who've said, oh, our food system needs to be reviewed and we need to do something about the situation of inequality. And others who've kind of gone, I can't deal with this. Let's just forget about it in the short term.
Let's talk about you for a bit. Tell me about your early life, and perhaps anyone who influenced you, during that time.
Well, I grew up in a place called Darlington in County Durham. So my parents come from Ghana in West Africa, and they came to the UK as students. They both were training in Edinburgh. My dad got his first junior doctor job. I mean, he came to the kind of the northeast. So I think his first job was Sunderland, and then he got a job in Darlington, which is where he ended up staying. So both my parents worked in the local hospital. And growing up as a young child, it was mainly playing with doctors' kids and playing with farmers' kids. So,
Okay.
I was introduced to rural life quite early on because, friends had ponies or their parents were, I don't know, beef or dairy farmers. And so that wasn't unusual for me. It's as I was growing up that I realized that not everybody else's childhood was like that. Like going to visit cousins in London, it's like, where's the cattle market? Yeah, so it was a very kind of idyllic childhood. And what I didn't appreciate at the time was we did a lot of after school activities. We did Girl Guides, St John's Ambulance, all a range of sports and things. But you don't appreciate that the adults who are giving up their time, they're really teaching you about a whole range of things, a load of skills on communication, on just being yourself and learning to collaborate with other people, and also having that thirst for knowledge. And I think that's one of my takeaways is that, those adults are really handing on to the next generation a whole set of behaviours and then skills that are really useful in later life.
Yeah. When did you know that you wanted to have a career in food generally?
That again was from a young age. I mean, I really enjoyed when I was a kid just playing with food. So back in the 70s, everything was cooked from scratch. So I loved helping my mother chop up vegetables and, going out in the garden. We used to grow sweet corn and things like that. And I enjoyed that side of it. But as a teenager, you do your biology projects and you learn about food. And I did a project on cultivating yogurt and realized
Yeah.
that, you can have a whole factory for doing that. And that's where
Yeah.
my fascination, I think, of food science came from, that the little experiments that I was doing at home, they actually happen in real life on a much, much greater scale, a much grander scale. And when I was about 16, I think it would have been, or maybe 15, we had a careers day at school, and I'd spoken to the school about what I was interested in, and they brought a food scientist just to talk to me.
I
Nobody
went.
else was interested in this, and right, okay, let's get some
They're
me for the
like, she knows
quiz.
what she wants to do. Pounce on this.
They were on it. So I spoke to this lady for the whole session. She was brilliant, and she really sparked that energy in me. Is that, I want to do what she does. And she was working as a food scientist in industry. And I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to apply for at university. And that's actually what I did, but I didn't get the grade I needed in chemistry at the time. So I ended up switching to food technology, which actually suited
That's
me a
really
lot
interesting.
better
Okay.
because it's a multifaceted course. It's multidisciplinary in that you're not just focusing on one pure science. You're looking at food microbiology, food chemistry, food engineering, food manufacture, and then you're also looking from a personnel side, human resources, entrepreneurship. So So that actually turned out really well in my favour. So I'd say to anybody who's got kids doing A-levels, don't panic, there's always a solution.
Yeah.
I went on from Reading to do a master's at Cranfield University. And
yeah,
Cranfield
in post-harvest technology, which sounds fantastic. Yeah, sounds it really was, fascinating.
Back in the 90s, remember, it was the time when we were having fresh fruit salads and bag salads and cut produce, like, you know, green beans that had the ends chopped off already in a bag. So the whole post-harvest technology, the extension of life of fresh produce, was very new and very exciting. So I went into fresh produce technology or post-harvest technology at that period. So it really was a great period to be doing that. And it obviously was a springboard for my career as well.
So after graduating, you worked in the Ugandan agribusiness sector for a few years. What were you doing during that time?
So I started off, because at Silso College, where I was at Cranfield University, they had a charity called SAFAD, which they'd use to help different communities, and they'd have projects in different countries around the world. And people from that kind of university, it's all postgrad with specialist knowledge. And I thought, you know, you go and you're helping a community do something, but actually the community is teaching you a lot of things that you didn't already know. So coming out with a master's degree, you kind of think, oh yeah, I've learned about this, that and the other. But, you know, working with subsistence farmers and seeing how they have to adapt to life and how they feed their families and how the communities work was a real eye-opener for me. So I learned a lot from that experience, not just about how you manage crops post-harvest, which is really what I was interested in, but the whole piece about how it's interrelated into society, which I think sparks my kind of feel for understanding how society works. And so even though I'd never done geography to any high level of education, you know, I kind of did it to GCSE, and I'd never done any social sciences, I think that's where my passion for social science started.
Okay. And yeah.
Realise it's not just about the science, it's how you apply the science that's really important.
You could have gone in so many different directions, but you chose to return to Europe and have a European base. Let's go back to the UK and to France, because you worked across a number of different roles in that time, everything from food procurement to technical innovation to food safety. But I want to stick on this sort of travel front as well, because that links into your Nuffield. Has travel and seeing these different places, different systems in different countries been important for your personal development, I suppose, but also your professional development and seeing that wide base of different things across food?
Well, I'd like to say that I went to all these countries and I absorbed lots of knowledge and really interacted well with the people, but a lot of the time it was trial and error, and sometimes there was quite a bit of error. Because, you know, I know now there's that phrase, is it cultural sensitivity or cultural intelligence, like you have emotional intelligence and cultural intelligence. Well, I had none of that when I started. So I picked it up as I went along, usually by making mistakes, you know, that you say hello to people in the wrong way, or I've been to one country where I said hello in the wrong language, and you think you're really cool. And I know that was the country before, sorry. So I feel like I've
where am I again?
So yes, I think I have learned by mistake, but it does help round you, because it helps you understand why cultural intelligence is so important, why you need to research the countries that you're going to, learn the language, understand how people think. And it's not just about doing a desktop type thing, it's about getting to know people really well. And you can't do that the same way in each country. There's some countries where people are more reserved, others where people are really quite nosy. And it's about changing your register to fit the situation that you're in. And, you know, I learned that the hard way. I wasn't an expert, you know, even though I spoke French when I went to France, I'd ask daft questions, I'd use the wrong tenses, you know, and say, oh, it doesn't matter, they know what I mean. And people are like, no, that matters.
but so, I assume also as a consultant, almost that learning, those lessons were actually really important for what you do now.
Definitely, because now, I mean, I don't just see my job as imparting technical knowledge from a food safety or nutrition point of view. I see my job as working with people to make the right decisions with the right information. And if you can't work with people, it doesn't matter what you tell them, it just goes straight over the top. So building relationships is one of the most important things about what I do that can then help people to make the right decisions in their business.
Let's talk about your Nuffield. So in 2017, you began your Nuffield scholarship, which was on vegetable production for specific nutritional need. Now, every Nuffield seems to have a story of some crisis or adventure that they've had on their travels. Did anything out of the ordinary happen to you?
Well, do you know what? When I did the Global Focus Programme, which was the, you know, 6 weeks, well, 7 weeks, six countries with a group of 11 people, I think we only had one flight that didn't happen because there was a storm or the pilot got delayed or something. All of our journeys went ahead on time, on schedule, what? Without a drama. We did the whole world. This? And there was like one internal flight that didn't work. So we just went, oh, let's get the bus. There's a bus that takes us and drops us right outside where we need to go. It's like, why have we taken a flight anyway? So it was just serendipity. But when I plan my own travel, I'm quite risk averse. So even though I'm a bit kind of out there and, you know, like to do things a bit differently, there's certain things that I don't like to mess with. And I like to know that I'm always going to be in a safe environment. And when I decided that I was going to go to China and have a look at what was happening there, a few people took me aside and said, well, okay, if you're going to go to China, you really need to research this and think of how you're going to be comfortable, because there was a trip that had gone out, a GFP tour that had gone out with Nuffield before, and one of the girls was South African, and she really had a bad time because a lot of the Chinese people have never seen a black person before. And the way they interact with black people isn't particularly pleasant for you as a person. They don't mean any harm, but you don't want to be the focus of attention in that way where everyone's grabbing your hair and touching your skin and looking at you. And, you know, it is quite nerve-wracking. And also, when you don't know the language or know the culture, you don't necessarily know how to interpret things. Yeah. So I thought, well, I need to be aware of the cultural insensitivities and, you know, make sure that I have a good situation to arrive to. So I decided to do a homestay. So I went online, there's a homestay organisation that you can apply to, and found a family that I could stay with for a week. And that meant that every night I had a group of people I could talk to, learn from, speak about the culture, and also give me guidance on how to get the tube and do all those kind of things. But I think I could have really had an issue in Shanghai if I hadn't had done that, because it was really stressful going out every day and people stop me. Some people would sometimes, they'd be doing their daily business and they'd catch my eye and then they'd realise that what they've seen, and then they'd just stock still in the middle of the street and just point and look at me.
Not self-conscious at all.
It's like, oh, I'll just carry on with what I'm doing.
Wow.
So yeah, it was, I mean, I'm laughing now, but at the time, by the time I got to the end of the week, it was actually quite draining, because people keep stopping you or they want to take selfies with you, and they don't sort of come up and tap you on the shoulder and ask politely because they don't speak your language. They just run up to you, put their arm around you, get the camera and take a selfie, and you're like, who are you? But you know, there were some of the kindest people I met. So I arrived at the airport, really helpful. Obviously you've got to pay for everything, but everybody wanted to talk. And even if they couldn't speak English, they still wanted to show that they wanted to make you feel welcome in their space. So yes, it had its pluses as well as its minuses.
Yeah. That's an impossible question in many ways. And Nuffields hate it when I ask them, but because they've spent all this time and hours putting into their report, but can you summarize your conclusions of your report and what your key sort of take-home messages were?
One of my key take-home messages was that if the fresh produce industry didn't get its act together, then the kind of meat substitute, meat replacement would overtake it in terms of importance in people's diets. And that's exactly what we've seen. So 3 years later, we've seen double-digit growth in artificial or meat replacement type foods and single-digit growth in fruit and vegetables. And it's a shame that, you know, I was saying that's what was going to happen and that's what's happened. So clearly my Nuffield report hasn't changed the world. But I think what we're realising is we need to get the message out on the relevance of vegetables in the diet. So even though we've had a massive trend on veganism and on plant-based eating, it hasn't actually included plants. So something's gone a little bit wrong there. So that was one of my findings. The other take-home message was that we need to work in a multidisciplinary way. So it's not good enough for us to just focus on, if you're a farmer, you connect with other farmers. It's about looking at the health sector. It's looking at education. It's looking at the Treasury. It's looking at all the different government departments that can get involved and have a say in how food is produced and distributed, because there are 16 government departments that get involved in food policy in the UK. So we really need to ensure that everybody's working together and not just trying to plough one particular street or plough one furrow in one particular area. We need to work together across different disciplines.
Yeah. Do you think, though, outside of a Nuffield context, is there still room and progress to be made in terms of linking conversations between farming and food?
Definitely, and that's one of my ambitions, you know, since I came back from finishing my Nuffield studies, is to be able to network people with people so that you bring finance, education, farming, health all together, and people can have the same information, share it, and you can use that to share learnings, you can use it to share best practice and help people generally understand better about their food environment and food systems, because we're seeing a lot of complex messages coming out, or messages that should be complex but get watered down into kind of, I don't know, bite-sized quotations that don't really mean anything. And I think if we want to have a meaningful conversation, we need to be able to say to people, actually, it's complicated.
That links in quite nicely to the next question, actually. So in 2018, you became a director of the Oxford Farming Conference. What does that involve, and why did you want to take on a director role?
I attended the Oxford Farming Conference because a good friend of mine who was a Nuffield Farming Scholar was speaking, and she said, oh, no one else can make it, you have to come. So I'd never been before, I didn't really know much about it. I knew that lots of people from Nuffield went there and, you know, talked about it well, but you kind of think, well, that's not for me, it wasn't in my world. And then I went to the conference, and I was just blown away. I made so many new friends. I learned so much new information about what was happening. It was a great networking experience, and I was so motivated, and everyone was so passionate about the food sector and what they were talking about. So the whole agri-food area. And I just thought, how have I not had Oxford Farming Conference in my life before? And I was so enthused. I literally went home and I was all over social media talking about it and just really bouncing off the walls with enthusiasm. Yeah. And then one of my friends who I'd bumped into at the time, I happened to sit next to her in a couple of sessions, she said to me, well, they're looking for new directors. And I thought, well, is that really for me? Should I know, you'd be brilliant. You should put in an application. So of course you do, thinking you're never going to get picked. When I got the call for an interview, I was like, oh, this is actually happening.
Government's released a new obesity strategy relatively recently. Are you optimistic about that?
Well, my view on it is that somebody somewhere will benefit, but I don't think they've dug deep enough, really, because we know that obesity isn't the fault of the person who's obese. It's a structural thing with many complex issues. And I think if you've got a complex problem, you use a range of different tools, and telling people that they need to do a bit more cycling and, you know, having adverts, no adverts on certain types of food before 9 o'clock. I kind of feel that they're chipping away at things, but it's not really a strategy. There's no real kind of KPIs that say we need to be at X point by Y time, and this is how we're going to hold ourselves accountable. You know, if they were saying that we're going to make sure that we reduce poverty and make sure that people have got enough money to pay for healthy food, or we're going to subsidize healthy food and we're going to help people with access to food. So for example, if they aren't good at cooking or haven't got the facilities, they can get a hot meal every day in a community centre or at work, or well, none of those things are there.
So as a nutritional consultant, you would actually advise that we need to be going much further?
Definitely, yeah. There'll be some people who benefit. I just don't see that most people will benefit. Yeah.
Based on that, do you think government has a responsibility to nudge citizens towards a healthier diet and lifestyle, and is it enough, or indeed sensible, I suppose, for the market to dictate and lead, given the cost, say, to the NHS, etc., etc.?
I think it's a little bit of both, because, you know, within the population, you've got people with different lifestyles and different personalities. There are people who respond really well to nudging and people who don't. There are also people who respond very well to marketing and people who don't. So it's about horses for courses. And that's why I think having a range of tools in the toolkit rather than just one kind of overarching woolly strategy is the way forward. Because I think with the food industry, there are parts of the food industry that will not change without policy because they feel that it's not a level playing field. So if they decide to reformulate and it makes the product more expensive or it reduces their profit margin, then it's benefiting the competition. So you need to at least have a benchmark that everybody has to reach, and then it makes it easier for market forces to work with that. Whereas if you're saying, well, if you want to, you can make healthier food, then where's the incentive if somebody else has to invest more time, energy and money in doing that? And there's no actual financial gain, and they could actually be penalized because they've still got to pay for the raw materials, they've still got to pay the workers, they've still got to pay for the equipment and reinvest in their business. Whereas somebody who's making a cheaper product and hasn't done any of that is still getting the same profit margin. So we need to look at how we incentivize people. And I think where I feel that PHE, as was, or whatever it's going to be now, has stopped short is that, yes, it's had the 5-a-day campaign, but that hasn't really gained any traction. And where they have been quite bullish has been on advice such as reduce saturated fat, take out salt and reduce salt to reduce sugar, reduce calories. Whereas we know that there are things that are missing from our diet that we really want to add. So there's all that conversation that's missing around, we need more fiber, we need more vitamin A, we need more iron. So if you can have those conversations and incentivize people that it's better to start adding these things in, then they've got something to focus on that's making their product better. It's not just about taking stuff out, if that makes sense. Mm. So the two, the policy and the marketing, do need to work hand in hand.
Bringing it back to a farming context, do you think that, and perhaps specifically a UK farming context, but I think we can push it out globally as well, do you think farming and health are linked sufficiently?
I'd say we can do better. I think there are links, and I do see people starting to make those links, but I think it would be better to have it so that people realise that there's a consequence to their actions. So whatever you're growing, somebody's going to eat that, you know, that's going to end up as somebody's meal. And if that's not a particularly healthy food, then there has to be a conversation about that. And I feel sorry a bit for farmers because they're at the primary end. So if you're a potato grower, you're not dictating whether your potatoes go into a mashed potato or whether they go into crisps, but you know, the food manufacturer does. But obviously there's certain products, if you're growing sugar beet, you can't pretend that that's benefiting somebody's health anywhere along the line, because it's a nice to have rather than a must have. Whereas somebody who's growing broccoli, you know, there's very little that you can do with that to make it less healthy. Yeah, I think we do need to join up farming and health and understand that there is a responsibility for everybody to work together to try and improve the health of our population.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually. And it relates onto the next conversation I wanted to have with you, which is whether the farming industry, I suppose, has any responsibility, or what the role of the farming industry is in that conversation of marketing the nutritional advantages of various products.
I think so. And I was really encouraged to see an ad campaign by AHDB about, I think it was back in March time, where it was a girl who was playing on a phone looking at social media and all these things about losing weight and eating this and not eating that. And she goes down to sit at the table with her family to eat a meal. And on that plate, you see some meat, a jacket potato, some vegetables. And it was lovely. Just I get so excited and emotional about it. It was a balanced plate of food, because I think up until now, it's all been, you know, the milk board saying drink milk, the egg board saying, you know, eat eggs, and British beef and lamb saying eat British beef and lamb. And it's like, no, people eat meals. They don't eat commodities. No one goes out and says, right, this is going to be an egg week this week. You know, you're having eggs with your breakfast, or you're having eggs in a meal, or you're having vegetables as part of a meal, or meat as part of a meal. So all the components should be there. And I think what we've been guilty of in the past is getting behind a particular group of producers to support them without thinking of the long-term consequences.
That's such a good point.
You know, nutritionists have been the worst at this, saying, well, everybody was eating too much red meat, now you need to eat more poultry. Oh, what's happened? The poultry industry is now massive. Everyone's eating so much chicken. I'm sort of sitting back and thinking, well, was that a sustainable thing to recommend? Now that the chicken production has far exceeded any expectation that we ever had, and is probably higher than the beef production. So not having joined up messages is really a problem, because you've got a group of people saying, this is what we need to amend in our diet, and a group of people saying, this is what we need to keep our industry going. Well, the two things have to interlink. And the fact of the matter is we're nearly self-sustaining in red meat and eggs, for example, and having to import 60% of our fruit and vegetables. And, you know, I'm not saying we have to be self-sustaining, but what I am saying is that we need to look at how we promote what we grow and what we eat, because at the moment we're not eating enough fresh fruit and vegetables at any form, never mind fresh. But our meat consumption has been higher overall as a population. Obviously, there are subpopulations that don't eat enough meat, and that's dangerous because they're not looking after their health. But overall, you know, it could be that we just need to redress the balance and make sure that we encourage having a balanced diet and a balanced plate, like the AHDB message was trying to put out.
I always finish the show with a couple of questions to every guest. The first one is, if you had a message to the public, any message, what would it be and why?
My message would be, evaluate information. If something it looks too easy and too good to be true, then it probably is. Dig deeper, check your sources. If something has come from social media, dig down and see whether that is the correct information. Look at the sources and see whether you can find who originally said it, because scientists are there doing some really good work. Don't dismiss them. They really are putting out some useful information, and easy, quick to absorb messages aren't telling the whole story. There's always another part of the story that you don't see.
And finally, a message to farmers.
I thought long and hard about this, because farmers, you know, they've got so many different problems and so many different skills. One message to all farmers.
It's a hard one.
It's a hard one. And I think what a lot of farmers I've seen do really well is kind of look at where they're at and constantly move forward and reinvent themselves. And I would say that as farmers, don't wait for policy. If there's something that you can do now, just go on ahead and do it, because I think policy is going to be behind the pace of change. So change what you can now and don't wait for policy.
Well said. Barbara, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been really, really interesting just getting your perspective, because I know you work with such a broad range of people, and like we were, your network really is massive. So it's great to have that perspective. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Meet the Farmer's Friends.
Big thanks to Barbara, and don't forget that you can watch all Meet the Farmers interviews on YouTube by searching for Meet the Farmers podcast. That's it for this week. I'm taking a week off next week, so the podcast will be returning on the 14th of September, when I'll be speaking to Northumbrian farmer Sally Irwin. Have a great fortnight, and I'll see you next time.